On the wings of a dragon. Aragorn lifted his head, took a deep breath, and felt a portion of his worries recede. Riding a dragon was far from restful, but being so close to Saphira was calming for both him and her. The simple pleasure of physical contact comforted them in a way few things did. Also, the constant sound and motion of her flight helped distract him from the black thoughts that had been dogging him. Despite the urgency of their trip and the precarious nature of their circumstances in general, Aragorn was glad to be away from the Varden. The recent bloodshed had left him feeling as if he was no longer quite himself. Ever since he had rejoined the Varden at Feinster, he had spent the bulk of his time fighting or waiting to fight, and the strain was beginning to wear on him, especially after the violence and horror of Drasleona. On the Varden's behalf, he had killed hundreds of soldiers, few of whom stood even the slightest chance of harming him. And though his actions had been justified, the memories troubled him. He did not want every fight to be desperate, and every opponent to be his equal or his better, far from it. But at the same time, the easy slaughter of so many made him feel more like a butcher than a warrior. Death, he had come to believe, was a corrosive thing, and the more he was around it, the more it gnawed away at who he was. However, being alone with Saphira and Gleda, although the Golden Dragon had kept to himself since their departure, helped Aragorn regain a sense of normalcy. He felt most comfortable alone or in small groups, and he preferred not to spend time in a town or a city, or even a camp like the Varden's. Unlike the majority of people, he did not hate or fear the wilderness. As harsh as the empty lands were, they possessed a grace and a beauty that no artifice could compete with, and that he found restorative. So he let Saphira's flying distract him, and for the better part of the day, he did nothing more important than watch the landscape slide past. From the Varden's camp by the banks of Leona Lake, Saphira set out across the broad expanse of water, angling northwest, and climbing so high that Aragorn had to use a spell to shield himself from the cold. The lake appeared patchy, shining and sparkling in areas where the angle of the waves reflected the sunlight toward Saphira, dull and grey where it did not. Aragorn never tired of staring at the constantly changing patterns of light. Nothing else in the world was quite like it. Fisher hawks, cranes, geese, ducks, starlings and other birds often flew by underneath them. Most ignored Saphira, but a few of the hawks spiraled upward and accompanied her for a short while, seeming more curious than frightened. Two were even so bold as to swerve in front of her, mere feet from her long, sharp teeth. In many ways, the fierce, hook-clawed, yellow-beaked raptors reminded Aragorn of Saphira herself, an observation that pleased her, for she admired the hawks as well, though not so much for their appearance as for their hunting prowess. The shore behind them gradually faded to a hazy purple line, then vanished altogether. For over half an hour, they saw only birds and clouds in the sky, and the vast sheet of wind-hammered water that covered the surface of the earth. Then ahead and to their left, the jagged grey outline of the spine began to appear along the horizon, a welcome sight to Aragorn. Although these were not the mountains of his childhood, they still belonged to the same range, and seeing them, he felt not quite so far from his old home. The mountains grew in size until the stony, snow-capped peaks loomed before them like the broken battlements of a castle wall. Down their dark, green-covered flanks, dozens of white streams tumbled, wending their way through the creases in the land until they joined with the great lake that lay pressed against their foothills. A half-dozen villages sat upon the shore or close thereby, but on account of Aragorn's magic, the people below remained oblivious to Saphira's presence as she sailed overhead. As he looked at the villages, it struck Aragorn just how small and isolated they were, and in hindsight, how small and isolated Carvajal had been. Compared to the great cities he had visited, the villages were little more than clusters of hovels, barely fit for even the meanest of paupers. Many of the men and women within them, he knew, had never travelled more than a few miles from their birthplace, and would live their whole lives in a world bound by the limits of their sight. What a blinkered existence, he thought. And yet he wondered if it was perhaps better to remain in one place and learn all you could about it, rather than to constantly roam across the land. Was a broad but shallow education superior to one that was narrow but deep? He was not sure. He remembered Oromis once telling him that the whole of the world could be deduced from the smallest grain of sand, if one studied it closely enough. The spine was only a fraction of the height of the Beor Mountains, yet the slab-sided peaks still towered 1,000 feet or more above Sephira as she threaded her way between them, following the shadow-filled gorges and valleys that split the range. Now and then she had to soar upward to clear a bare snowy pass, and when she did, and Aragorn's range of view widened, he thought the mountains looked like so many molars erupting from the brown gums of the earth. As Sephira glided over a particularly deep valley, he saw at the bottom a glade with a ribbony stream wandering across the field of grass, and along the edges of the glade he glimpsed what he thought might have been houses, or perhaps tents, it was hard to tell, hidden under the eaves of the heavy-boughed spruce trees that populated the flanks of the neighbouring mountains. A single spot of firelight shone through a gap in the branches, like a tiny chip of gold embedded within the layers of black needles. And he thought he spied a lone figure lumbering away from the stream. The figure appeared strangely bulky, and its head seemed too large for its body. I think that was an Urgal.
Where?
Sephira asked, and he sensed her curiosity. In the clearing behind us. He shared the memory with her. I wish we had the time to go back and find out. I'd like to see how they live. She snorted. Hot smoke streamed out of her nostrils, then rolled down her neck and over him.
They might not take kindly to a dragon and rider landing among them without warning.
He coughed and blinked as his eyes watered. Do you mind? She did not answer, but the line of smoke trailing from her nostrils ceased, and the air around him soon cleared. Not long afterward, the shape of the mountains began to look familiar to Aragorn, and then a large rift opened up before Sephira, and he realized they were flying across the pass that led to Tirm, the same pass he and Brom had twice ridden through on horseback. It was much as he remembered it. The western branch of the Tork River still flowed fast and strong toward the distant sea, the surface of the water streaked with white mare's tails, where boulders interrupted its course. The crude road he and Brom had followed by the side of the river was still a pale, dusty line, barely wider than a deer trail. He even thought he recognized a clump of trees where they had stopped to eat. Sephira turned westward and proceeded down the river until the mountains dropped away to lush, rain-soaked fields, whereupon she adjusted her course to a more northerly direction. Aragorn did not question her decision. She never seemed to lose her bearing, not even on a starless night, or when deep underground in Farthendur. The sun was close to the horizon when they flew out of the spine. As dusk settled over the land, Aragorn occupied himself by trying to devise ways to trap, kill, or fool Galbatorix. After a time, Glaedhr emerged from his self-imposed isolation and joined him in his efforts. They spent an hour or so discussing various strategies, and then they practiced attacking and defending each other with their minds. Sephira participated in the exercise as well, but with limited success, as flying made it difficult for her to concentrate on anything else. Later, Aragorn stared at the cold white stars for a while. Then he asked Glaedhr, could the Vault of Souls contain Eldunari that the riders hid from Galbatorix?
No,
said Glaedhr without hesitation.
It's impossible. Oromis and I would have known if Freyll had sanctioned such a plan. And if any Eldunari had been left on Vroengard, we would have found them when we returned to search the island. It's not so easy to hide a living creature as you seem to think.
Why not?
If a hedgehog rolls into a ball, that doesn't mean that he becomes invisible now, does it? Minds are no different. You can shield your thoughts from others, but your existence is still apparent to anyone who searches the area.
Surely with a spell you could...
If a spell had tampered with our senses, we would have known, for we had wards to prevent that from happening.
So, no Eldunari, Aragorn concluded glumly.
Unfortunately not.
They flew on in silence, as the waxing three-quarter moon rose above the jagged peaks of the spine. By its light, the land looked as if it were made out of pewter, and Aragorn amused himself by imagining that it was an immense sculpture the dwarves had carved and stored within a cave as large as Alagazia itself. Aragorn could feel the pleasure Gleda took in their flight. Like Aragorn and Saphira, the old dragon seemed to welcome the opportunity to leave behind their concerns on the ground, if even only for a short while, and to soar freely through the sky. It was Saphira who spoke next. Between the slow, heavy flaps of her wings, she said to Gleda,
"Tell us a story, Ebrithil. What manner of story would you hear? The tale of how you and Oromis were captured by the Forsworn, and how you then escaped."
At this, Aragorn's interest increased. He had always been curious about the matter himself, but he had never worked up the courage to ask Oromis. Gleda was quiet for a span, then said,
"When Galbatorix and Morzan returned from the wilds and began their campaign against our order, we did not at first realize the severity of the threat. We were concerned, of course, but no more than if we had discovered that a shade was stalking the land. Galbatorix was not the first rider to go mad, although he was the first to have acquired a disciple such as Morzan. That alone should have warned us of the danger we faced, but the truth was only apparent in hindsight. At the time, we failed to consider that Galbatorix might have gathered other followers, or that he would even attempt such a thing. It seemed absurd that any of our brethren could prove susceptible to Galbatorix's poisonous whisperings. Morzan was still a novice. His weakness was understandable. But those who were already riders in full? We never questioned their loyalties, for only when they were tempted did they reveal the extent to which their spite and weaknesses had corrupted them. Some wanted revenge for old hurts. Others believed that by virtue of our power, dragons and riders deserved to rule over the whole of Alagazia. And others, I'm afraid to say, simply enjoyed the chance to tear down what was and indulge themselves however they wanted."
The old dragon paused, and Aragorn sensed ancient hates and sorrows shading his mind. Then Gleda continued,
"Events at that point were confusing. Little was known, and what reports we received were so larded with rumours and speculation as to be useless. Oromis and I began to suspect that something far worse was afoot than most realized. We tried to convince several of the older dragons and riders, but they disagreed and dismissed our concerns. Fools they were not, but centuries of peace had clouded their vision, and they were unable to see that the world was shifting around us. Frustrated with the lack of information, Oromis and I left Deliria to discover what we could for ourselves. We brought two young riders with us, both elves and accomplished warriors, who had recently returned from scouting the northern reaches of the Spine. It was partly at their urging that we ventured forth on our expedition. Their names you might recognize, for they were Kialandi and Formora."
"Ah," said Aragorn, suddenly understanding.
"Yes. After a day and a half of travelling, we stopped at Edur Narak, a watchtower built of old to stand guard over Silverwood Forest. Unbeknownst to us, Kialandi and Formora had visited the tower beforehand and slain the three elven rangers stationed there. Then they had placed a trap upon the stones that ring the tower. A trap that caught us the moment my claws touched the grass upon the knoll. It was a clever spell. Galbatorix had taught it to them himself. We had no defense against it, for it caused us no harm, only held us and slowed us, like honey poured over our bodies and minds. While we were thus snared, minutes passed as seconds. Kialandi, Formora, and their dragons flitted around us faster than hummingbirds. They appeared as no more than dark blurs at the edges of our vision. When they were ready, they released us. They had cast dozens of spells. Spells to bind us in place, spells to blind us, and spells to prevent Oromis from speaking, so as to make it more difficult for him to cast spells. Again, their magic did not hurt us, and thus we had no defense against it. The moment we could, we attacked Kialandi, Formora, and their dragons with our minds, and they us. And for hours thereafter, we strove against them. The experience was not pleasant. They were weaker and less skilled than Oromis and I, but there were two of them for each of us, and they had with them the heart of hearts of a dragon named Ogieravel, whose rider they had slain, and her strength added to their own. As a result, we were hard-pressed to defend ourselves. Their intent, we discovered, was to force us to help Galbatorix and the Forsworn enter Illyria unnoticed, so that they might catch the riders by surprise and capture the Eldunari, who were then living in the city.
How did you escape? Asked Aragorn.
In time, it became clear that we would not be able to defeat them. So Oromis decided to risk using magic in an attempt to free us, even though he knew it would provoke Kialandi and Formora into attacking us with magic in return. It was a desperate ploy, but it was the only choice we had. At a certain point, without knowing of Oromis's plans, I struck back at our attackers, seeking to hurt them. Oromis had been waiting for just such a moment. He had long known the rider who had instructed Kialandi and Formora in the ways of magic, and he was well familiar with Galbatorix's twisted reasoning. From that knowledge, he was able to guess at how Kialandi and Formora had worded their spells, and where the flaws in their enchantments were likely to lie. Oromis had only seconds to act. The moment he began to use magic, Kialandi and Formora realized what he was about, panicked, and began to cast their own spells. It took Oromis 3 tries to break our bonds. How exactly he did it, I cannot say. I doubt whether he really understood it himself. Most simply, he shifted us a finger's breadth away from where we had been standing.
Like how Arya sent my egg from Duwelden Varden to the spine?
Asked Saphira.
Yes and no,
Glada replied.
Yes, he transported us from one place to another without moving us through the intervening space. But he did not just shift our position. He also shifted the very substance of our flesh, rearranged it, so that we were no longer what we once were. Many of the smallest parts of our bodies can be exchanged for one another without ill effect. And so he did, with every muscle, bone, and organ.
Aragorn frowned. Such a spell was a feat of the highest order, a wonder of magical dexterity that few in history could have hoped to carry out. Still, as impressed as Aragorn was, he could not help but ask, How could that have worked, though? You would still be the same person as before.
You would, and yet you would not. The difference between who we had been and who we then were was slight,
but it was enough to render useless the enchantments Kialandi and Fomora had woven about us.
What of the spells they cast once they noticed what Oramis was doing?
Asked Saphira. An image came to Aragorn of Gleda ruffling his wings, as if he were tired of sitting in one position for so long.
The first spell, Fomora's, was meant to kill us, but our wards stopped it. The second, which was from Kialandi, that was a different matter. It was a spell Kialandi had learned from Galbatorix, and he from the spirits who possessed Durza. This I know, for I was in contact with Kialandi's mind even when he wrought his enchantment. It was a clever, fiendish spell, the purpose of which was to prevent Oramis from touching and manipulating the flow of energy around him, and thereby to prevent him from using magic.
Did Kialandi do the same to you?
He would have, but he feared it would either kill me or sever my connection with my heart of hearts, and thus create two independent versions of me that they would then have to subdue. Even more than elves, dragons depend on magic for our existence. Without it, we would soon die.
Aragorn could sense Saphira's curiosity was aroused.
Has that ever happened? Has the connection between a dragon and the dragon's Eldunari ever been severed while the dragon's body was still alive?
It has, but that is a tale for another time.
Saphira subsided, but Aragorn could tell that she intended to raise the question again at the soonest opportunity. But Kialandi's spell didn't stop Oramis from being able to use magic, did it?
Not entirely. It was supposed to, but Kialandi cast the spell even as Oramis shifted us from place to place, and so its effect was somewhat lessened. Still, it kept him from working all but the smallest of magics, and as you know, the spell remained with him for the rest of his life, despite the efforts of our wisest healers.
Why didn't his wards protect him? Gleda seemed to sigh.
That is a mystery. No one had done such a thing before, Aragorn. And of those still living, only Galbatorix now knows the secret of it. The spell was bound to Oramis's mind, but it may not have affected him directly. Instead, it may have worked upon the energy around him, or upon his link to the same. The elves have long studied magic, but even they do not fully understand how the material and immaterial worlds interact. It is a riddle that will likely never be solved. However, it seems reasonable to assume that the spirits know more than we about both the material and the immaterial, considering that they are the embodiment of the second, and that they occupy the first when in the form of a shade. Whatever the truth may be, the outcome was this. Oramis cast his spell and he freed us, but the effort was too much for him, and a fit came over him, the first of many. Never again was he able to cast such a powerful spell, and ever after he suffered a weakness of the flesh that would have killed him if not for his skill with magic. The weakness was already in him when Kialandi and Fomora captured us, but when he shifted us and reshuffled the parts of our bodies, he brought it to the fore. Otherwise the malady might have lain dormant for many more years. Oramis fell to the ground, as helpless as a hatchling, even as Fomora and her dragon, an ugly brown thing, ran at us, the others close behind. I leaped over Oramis, and I attacked. If they had realized he was crippled, they would have taken advantage of his condition to slip into his mind and make it their own. I had to distract them until Oramis recovered. I have never fought harder than I did that day. There were four of them arrayed against me. Five, if you include Agaravel in the tally. Both of my kin, the brown and Gerlandi's purple, were smaller than me, but their teeth were sharp and their claws were vast. Still, my rage gave me a strength greater than normal, and I dealt grave wounds to them both. Gerlandi was foolish enough to come within my reach, and I grasped him with my talons and threw him at his own dragon.
Blader made a sound of amusement.
His magic did not protect him against that. One of the spikes on the purple's back impaled him, and I might have killed him then and there, had not the brown forced me to retreat. We must have fought for almost 5 minutes before I heard Oramis shout that we must flee. I kicked up dirt in the faces of my enemies, then returned to Oramis and grasped him in my right forepaw and took flight from Edor Narok. Gerlandi and his dragon could not follow, but Formora and the brown could, and did. They caught us less than a mile from the watchtower. We closed several times, and then the brown flew underneath me, and I saw Formora about to strike at my right leg with her sword. She was trying to force me to drop Oramis, I think, or perhaps she wanted to kill him. I twisted to evade the blow, and instead of my right leg, her sword struck my left, cutting it off.
The memory that passed through Glader's mind was that of a hard, cold, pinching sensation, as if Formora's blade had been forged of ice, not steel. The feeling made Aragorn queasy. He swallowed and tightened his grip on the front of the saddle, grateful that Saphira was safe.
It hurt less than you might imagine, but I knew that I could not continue to fight, so I turned and raced toward Illyria as fast as my wings could carry me. In a way, Formora's victory worked against her, for without the burden of my leg, I was able to outdistance the brown and thus escape. Oramis was able to stop the bleeding, but no more, and he was too weak to contact Vrail or the other Elder Riders and warn them of Galbatorix's plans. Once Gerlandi and Formora reported to him, we knew that Galbatorix would attack Illyria soon thereafter. If he waited, it would only give us time to fortify, and strong as he was, surprise was still Galbatorix's greatest weapon in those days. When we arrived at Illyria, we were dismayed to find that few of our order were still there. In our absence, more had left to search for Galbatorix or to consult with Vrail in person on Vroengard. We convinced those who remained of the danger, and we had them warn Vrail and the other Elder Dragons and Riders. They were loath to believe that Galbatorix had the forces needed to attack Illyria, or that he would dare do such a thing. But in the end, we were able to make them see the truth of the matter. As a result, they decided that all of the Eldunari in Alagasia should be taken to Vroengard for safekeeping. It seemed a prudent measure, but we should have sent them to Ellesmira instead. If nothing else, we should have left the Eldunari that were already in Dueldenvarden where they were. At least then some of them would have remained free of Galbatorix. Alas, none of us thought that they would be safer among the elves than on Vroengard, at the very center of our order. Vrail ordered every dragon and rider who was within a few days' journey of Illyria to hurry to the aid of the city, but Oramis and I feared they would be too late. Nor were we in any state to help defend Illyria, so we gathered what supplies we needed, and with our two remaining students, Brom and the dragon who is your namesake, Saphira, we left the city that very night. You have seen, I think, the faith Oramis made as we departed."
Aragorn nodded absently as he remembered the image of the beautiful tower-filled city, clustered about the base of an escarpment and lit by a rising harvest moon.
"And that is how it came to be, that we were not in Illyria when Galbatorix and the Forsworn attacked a few hours later. And it is also why we were not at Vloengard when the Oathbreakers defeated the combined might of all our forces and sacked Doru Areba. From Illyria we went to Duweldenvarden, in the hope that the elven healers might be able to cure Oromus's ailment and restore his ability to use magic. When they could not, we decided to remain where we were, for it seemed safer than flying all the way to Vroengard, when both of us were hampered by our injuries, and we might be ambushed at any point along the journey. Brom and Saphira did not stay with us, though. Despite our advice to the contrary, they went to join the fight. And it was in that fighting that your namesake died, Saphira. And now you know how the Forsworn capture us, and how we escaped."
After a moment, Saphira said,
"Thank you for the story, Eberithil." "You are welcome, Bjartskula. But never ask it of me again."
When the moon was nearing its zenith, Aragorn saw a nest of dim orange lights floating in the darkness. It took him a moment to realize they were the torches and lanterns of Teim, many miles away. And high above the other lights, a bright yellow spot appeared for a second, like a great eye glaring at him. Then it vanished and reappeared, flashing on and off in a never-changing cycle, as if the eye were blinking. "The lighthouse at Teim is lit," he said to both Saphira and Gleda.
"Then a storm is brewing," said Gleda.
Saphira's flapping ceased, and Aragorn felt her tip forward and begin a long, slow glide toward the ground. A half hour elapsed before she landed. By then, Teim was a faint glow to the south, and the beam from the lighthouse was no brighter than a star. Saphira alit on an empty beach, strewn with twisted driftwood. By the light of the moon, the hard, flat strand appeared almost white, while the waves that crashed into it were grey and black, and seemed angry, as if the ocean were trying to devour the land with each breaker it sent forth. Aragorn unbuckled the straps around his legs, then slid off Saphira, grateful for the opportunity to stretch his muscles. He noted the smell of brine as he sprinted down the strand toward a large chunk of driftwood, his cloak flapping behind him. At the piece of wood, he spun around and sprinted back to Saphira. She sat where he had left her, staring out to sea. He paused, wondering if she was going to speak, for he could feel a great strain within her. But when she remained silent, he turned on his heel and again sprinted to the driftwood. She would talk when she was ready. Back and forth Aragorn ran, until he was warm all over and his legs felt wobbly. And yet the whole time Saphira kept her gaze fixed on some point in the distance. As Aragorn threw himself down on a patch of sedge next to her, Gleda said,
"It would be foolish to try."
Aragorn cocked his head, unsure to whom the dragon was speaking.
"I know I can do it," said Saphira. "You have never before been to Vroengard," said Gleda. "And if there is a storm, it might drive you far out to sea, or worse. More than one dragon has perished because of overweening confidence. The wind is not your friend, Saphira. It can help you, but it can also destroy you."
"I am not a hatchling to be instructed about the wind."
"No, but you are still young, and I do not think you are ready for this."
"The other way would take too long."
"Perhaps. But better to get there safely than not at all."
"What are you talking about?" Aragorn asked. The sand under Sephira's front feet made a gritty rustling sound as she flexed her claws, sinking them deep into the earth.
"We have a choice to make,"
said Glader.
"From here, Sephira can either fly straight to Vroengard or follow the coastline north until she reaches the point on the mainland closest to the island. And then, only then, turn west and cross the sea."
"Which path would be faster?" Aragorn asked, although he had already guessed the answer.
"Flying straight there," said Sephira. "But if she does, then she would be over the water the whole time."
Sephira bristled.
"It's no farther than it was from the Varden to here. Or am I wrong?" "You're more tired now. And if there is a storm, then I'll fly around it,"
she said, and huffed, releasing a spike of blue and yellow flame from her nostrils. The flame branded itself into Aragorn's vision, leaving behind a flashing afterimage. "Ah, now I can't see!" He rubbed his eyes as he tried to help the afterimage fade away. "Would flying straight there really be all that dangerous?"
"It could be,"
rumbled Glader. "How much longer would it take to go along the coastline?"
"Half a day, maybe a bit more."
Aragorn scratched the stubble on his chin as he stared at the forbidding mass of water. Then he looked up at Sephira and in a low voice said, "Are you sure you can do this?" She twisted her neck and returned his gaze with one huge eye. Her pupil had expanded until it was nearly circular. It was so large and black, Aragorn felt as if he could crawl into it and disappear altogether.
"As sure as I can be," she said.
He nodded and ran his hands through his hair as he accustomed himself to the idea. "Then we have to chance it. Glader, if need be, you can guide her? You can help her?" The old dragon was quiet for a while. Then he surprised Aragorn by humming in his mind, even as Sephira hummed when she was pleased or amused.
"Very well. If we are to tempt fate, then let us not be cowards about it. Across the sea it is."
The matter settled. Aragorn climbed back onto Sephira, and with a single bound she left behind the safety of solid land and took flight over the trackless waves. The sound of his voice, the touch of his hand.
"Ah!"
"Will you swear your fealty to me in the ancient language?"
"Never."
His question and her answer had become a ritual between them, a call and response such as children might use in a game. Except that in this game, she lost even when she won. Rituals were all that allowed Nasuada to maintain her sanity. By them, she ordered her world. By them, she was able to endure from one moment to the next, for they gave her something to hold on to when all else had been stripped from her. Rituals of thought, rituals of action, rituals of pain and relief. These had become the framework upon which her life depended. Without them, she would have been lost, a sheep without a shepherd, a devotee bereft of faith, a rider separated from her dragon. Unfortunately, this particular ritual always ended in the same way, with another touch of the iron. She screamed and bit her tongue, and blood filled her mouth. She coughed, trying to clear her throat, but there was too much blood, and she began to choke. Her lungs burned from a lack of air, and the lines on the ceiling wavered and grew dim. And then her memory ceased, and there was nothing, not even darkness. Afterward, Galbatorix spoke to her while the irons heated. This, too, had become one of their rituals. He had healed her tongue. At least she thought it had been him and not Murtagh, for as he said,
"It wouldn't do if you were unable to speak, now would it?
How else will I know when you are ready to serve me? As before, the king sat to her right, at the very edge of her vision, where all she could see of him was a gold-edged shadow, his form partially hidden beneath the long, heavy cape he wore. I met your father, you know, when he was steward of Enduriel's chief estate, said Galbatorix. Did he tell you of that? She shuddered and closed her eyes and felt tears seep from the corners. She hated listening to him. His voice was too powerful, too seductive. It left her wanting to do whatever he desired, just so she could hear him utter a tiny morsel of praise. Yes, she murmured.
I took little notice of him at the time. Why would I? He was a servant, no one of significance. Enduriel allowed him a fair bit of freedom, the better to manage the affairs of the estate. Too much freedom, as it turned out. The king made a dismissive gesture, and the light caught his lean, claw-like hand. Enduriel always was overly permissive. It was his dragon who was the cunning one. Enduriel merely did as he was told. What a strange, amusing series of events fate has arranged. To think, the man who saw to it that my boots were brightly polished went on to become my foremost enemy after Brom. And now here you are, his daughter, returned to Urbain and about to enter my service, even as did your father. How very ironic. Would you not agree?
My father escaped, and he nearly killed Durza when he did, she said. All your spells and oaths could not hold him, any more than you'll be able to hold me.
She thought Galbatorix might have frowned. Yes, that was unfortunate. Durza was quite put out about it at the time. Families seem to make it easier for people to change who they are, and thus their true names, which is why I now choose my household servants only from those who are barren and unwed. However, you are sorely mistaken if you think to slip your bonds. The only ways to leave the Hall of the Soothsayer are by swearing loyalty to me, or by dying.
Then I will die.
How very short-sighted.
The gilded shadow of the king leaned toward her.
Have you never entertained the thought, Nasawada, that the world would have been worse off had I not overthrown the Riders?
The Riders kept the peace, she said. They protected the whole of Alagasia from war, from plague, from the threat of shades. In times of famine, they brought food to the starving. How is this land a better place without them?
Because there was a price attached to their service. You of all people should know that everything in this world must be paid for, whether in gold, time, or blood. Nothing is without its price, not even the Riders. Especially not the Riders. Aye, they kept the peace, but they also stifled the races of this land, the elves and dwarves just as much as us humans. What is always said in praise of the Riders when the bards bemoan their passing? That their reign extended for thousands of years, and that during this much vaunted golden age, little changed, besides the names of the kings and queens who sat smug and secure upon their thrones. Oh, there were little alarms, a shade here, an incursion by Urgals there, a skirmish between two dwarf clans over a mine no one but they cared about. But on the whole, the order of things remained exactly the same as it had been when the Riders first rose to prominence. She heard the clink of metal against metal, as Murtagh stirred the coals in the brazier. She wished she could see his face, so that she could gauge his reaction to Galbatorix's words. But as was his habit, he stood with his back to her, staring down at the coals. The only time he looked at her was when he had to apply the white-hot metal to her flesh. That was his particular ritual. and she suspected he needed it as much as she needed hers. And still Galbatorix kept talking. "Does that not seem the most evil thing to you, Nasawada? Life is change, and yet the riders suppressed it so that the land lay in an uneasy slumber, unable to shake off the chains that bound it, unable to advance or retreat as nature intended, unable to become something new. I saw with my own eyes scrolls in the vaults at Vroengard and here in the vaults of Illyria, the detailed discoveries, magical, mechanical, and from every sphere of natural philosophy. Discoveries that the riders kept hidden, because they feared what might happen if those things became generally known. The riders were cowards, wedded to an old way of life and an old way of thinking, determined to defend it unto their dying breath. Theirs was a gentle tyranny, but a tyranny nevertheless."
"Were murder and betrayal really the solution, though?" she asked, not caring if he punished her for it.
He laughed, seeming genuinely amused.
"Such hypocrisy!
You condemn me for the very thing you seek to do. If you could, you would kill me where I sit, and with no more hesitation than were I a rabid dog."
"You're a traitor. I'm not."
"I am the victor. In the end, nothing else matters. We are not so different as you think, Nasawada. You wish to kill me because you believe my death would be an improvement for Alagazia, and because you, who are still almost a child, believe you can do a better job of ruling the Empire than I. Your arrogance would cause others to despise you, but not me, for I understand. I took up arms against the riders for those very same reasons, and I was right to do so."
"Did vengeance have nothing to do with it?"
She thought he smiled. "It might have provided the initial inspiration, but neither hate nor revenge was my guiding motive. I was concerned by what the riders had become, and convinced, as I still am, that only when they were gone could we flourish as a race." For a moment, the pain from her wounds made it impossible for her to talk. Then she managed to whisper,
"If what you say is true, and I have no cause to believe you, but if it is, then you are no better than the riders. You pillaged their libraries and gathered up their stores of knowledge, and as of yet, you have shared none of that lore with anyone else."
He moved nearer to her, and she felt his breath upon her ear. "That is because, scattered throughout their hoard of secrets, I found hints of a greater truth. A truth that could provide an answer to one of the most perplexing questions in history." A shiver ran down her spine.
"What question?"
He leaned back in his chair and tugged at the edge of his cape. "The question of how a king or a queen can enforce the laws they enact when there are those among their subjects who can use magic. When I realized what the hints alluded to, I put aside all else and committed myself to hunting down this truth, this answer, for I knew it was of paramount importance. That is why I have kept the rider's secrets to myself. I have been busy with my search. The answer to this problem must be set into place before I make known any of those other discoveries. The world is already a troubled place, and it is better to soothe the waters before disturbing them once more. It took me nearly 100 years to find the information I needed, and now that I have, I shall use it to reshape the whole of Alagazia. Magic is the great injustice in the world. It would not be so unfair if the ability only occurred among those who were weak, for then it would be a compensation for what chance or circumstance had robbed them of. But it doesn't. The strong are just as likely to be able to use magic, and they gain more from it besides. One need only look to the elves to see this is true. The problem is not confined to individuals, It also plagues the relationships between the races. The elves find it easier than us to maintain order within their society, for most every elf can use magic, and therefore few of them are ever at the mercy of another. In this regard, they are fortunate. But it is not so fortunate for us, for the dwarves, or even for the accursed Urgals. We have only been able to live here in Alagazia because the elves permitted it. If they wanted, they could have swept us from the face of the earth as easily as a flood might sweep away an anthill. But no more. Not while I am here to oppose their might.
The riders would never have let them kill us or drive us away.
No, but while the riders existed, we were dependent upon their goodwill. And it is not right that we should have to rely on others for our safekeeping. The riders began as a means to keep the peace between elves and dragons, but in the end their main purpose became upholding the rule of law throughout the land. They were, however, insufficient to the task, as are my own spellcasters, the Black Hand. The problem is too far-reaching for any one group to combat. My own life is proof enough of that. Even if there were a trustworthy band of spellcasters, adept enough to watch over all the other magicians in Alagazia, ready to intervene at the slightest hint of malfeasance, we would still be reliant upon the very ones whose powers we sought to restrain. Ultimately, the land would be no safer than it is now. No, in order to solve this problem, it must be addressed on a deeper, more fundamental level. The ancients knew how that might be done. And now, so do I. Galbatorix shifted in the chair, and she caught a sharp gleam from his eye, as from a lantern set deep within a cave. I shall make it so that no magician will be able to harm another person, whether human, dwarf, or elf. None shall be able to cast a spell unless they have permission. And only magics that are benign and beneficial shall be allowed. Even the elves will be bound by this precept, and they shall learn to measure their words carefully, or speak not at all.
And who will grant permission? She asked. Who will decide what is allowed and what is not? You?
Someone must. It was I who recognized what was needed, I who discovered the means, and I who shall implement them. You sneer at the thought? Well then, ask yourself this, Nasuada. Have I been a bad king? Be honest now. By the standards of my forebears, I have not been excessive.
You have been cruel.
That is not the same thing. You have led the Varden. You understand the burdens of command. Surely you have realized the threat that magic poses to the stability of any kingdom. To give but one example, I have spent more time laboring over the enchantments that protect the coin of the realm from being forged than I have upon most any other aspect of my duties. And yet no doubt there is a clever-minded conjurer somewhere who has found a way to circumvent my wards, and who is busy making bags of lead coins with which he can fool nobles and commoners alike. Why else do you think I have been so careful to restrict the use of magic throughout the Empire?
Because it is a threat to you.
No, there you are exactly wrong. It is no threat to me, no one, and nothing is. However, spellcasters are a threat to the proper functioning of this realm, and that I shall not tolerate. Once I have bound every magician in the world to the laws of the land, imagine the peace and prosperity that shall reign. No more shall men or dwarves have to fear elves. No more shall riders be able to impose their will on others. No more shall those who cannot use magic be prey for those who can. Alagazia will be transformed. And with our newfound safety, we will build a more wondrous tomorrow. One you could be a part of. Enter into my service, Nasuada, and you will have the opportunity to oversee the creation of a world such as never existed before.
a world where a man will stand or fall based upon the strength of his limbs and the keenness of his mind, and not whether chance has granted him skill with magic. Man may build up his limbs, and man may improve his mind, but never can he learn to use magic if he was born lacking the ability. As I said, magic is the great injustice, and for the good of all, I will impose limits upon every magician there is." She stared at the lines on the ceiling and tried to ignore him. So much of what he said was similar to what she had thought herself. He was right. Magic was the most destructive force in the world, and if it could be regulated, Alagazia would be a better place for it. She hated that there had been nothing to stop Aragorn from... Blue, red, patterns of interwoven colour, the throbbing of her burns. She strove desperately to concentrate upon anything other than nothing. Whatever she had been about to think of was nothing, did not exist.
"You call me evil, you curse my name, and seek to overthrow me. But remember this, Nasawada, it was not I who started this war, and I am not responsible for those who have lost their lives as a result. I did not seek this out. You did. I would have been content to devote myself to my studies, but the Varden insisted upon stealing Saphira's egg from my treasure house, and you and your kind are responsible for all of the blood and sorrow that have followed. You are the ones, after all, who have been rampaging across the countryside, burning and pillaging as you please, not I. And yet you have the audacity to claim that I am in the wrong. Were you to go into the homes of the peasants, they would tell you that it is the Varden they fear most. They would talk about how they look to my soldiers for protection, and how they hope the Empire will defeat the Varden, and all shall be as it was." Nasawada wet her lips. Even though she knew her boldness might cost her, she said, "It seems to me you protest too much. If the welfare of your subjects were your main concern, you would have flown out to confront the Varden weeks ago, instead of letting an army roam loose within your borders. That is, unless you are not so sure of your might as you pretend. Or is it you fear the elves will take Urabane while you are gone?" As had become her habit, she spoke of the Varden as if she knew no more about them than any random person in the Empire. Galbatorix shifted, and she could tell he was about to respond, but she was not yet finished. "And what of the Urgles? You cannot convince me your cause is just when you would exterminate an entire race in order to ease your pain at the death of your first dragon. Have you no answer for that, Oathbreaker? Speak to me of the dragons, then. Explain why you slew so many that you doomed their kind to a slow and inevitable extinction. And finally, explain your mistreatment of the Eldonari you captured." In her anger, she allowed herself that one slip. "You have bent and broken them and chained them to your will. There is no rightness in what you do, only selfishness and a never-ending hunger for power." Galbatorix regarded her in silence for a long, uncomfortable while. Then she saw his outline move as he crossed his arms. "I think the irons ought to be sufficiently hot by now. Murtag, if you would." She clenched her fists, digging her nails into her skin, and her muscles began to tremble, despite her best efforts to hold them still. One of the iron rods scraped against the lip of the brazier as Murtag pulled it free. He turned to face her, and she could not help but stare at the tip of the glowing metal. Then she looked into Murtag's eyes, and she saw the guilt and self-loathing they contained, and a sense of profound sorrow overcame her.
"What fools we are," she thought. "What sorry, miserable fools."
After that, she had no more energy for thinking, and so she fell back into her well-worn rituals, clinging to them for survival, even as a drowning man might cling to a piece of wood. When Murtagh and Galbatorix departed, she was in too much pain to do more than gaze mindlessly at the patterns on the ceiling. While she struggled not to cry, she was sweating and shivering at the same time as if she had a fever, and she found it impossible to concentrate upon any one thing for more than a few seconds. The pain from her burns did not subside as it would have if she had been cut or bruised. Indeed, the throbbing from her wounds seemed to grow worse with time. She closed her eyes and concentrated upon slowing her breathing as she tried to calm her body. The first time Galbatorix and Murtagh had visited her, she had been far more courageous. She had cursed and taunted them and done all she could to hurt them with her words. However, through Murtagh, Galbatorix had made her suffer for her insolence, and she had soon lost her taste for open rebellion. The iron made her timid. Even the memory of it made her want to curl into a tight little ball. During their second, most recent visit, she had said as little as possible until her final imprudent outburst. She had tried to test Galbatorix's claim that neither he nor Murtagh would lie to her. She did this by asking them questions about the Empire's inner workings, facts that her spies had informed her of, but that Galbatorix had no reason to believe she knew. So far as she could determine, Galbatorix and Murtagh had told her the truth, but she was not about to trust anything the king said when there was no way to verify his claims. As for Murtagh, she was not quite so sure. When he was with the king, she gave no credence to his words. But when he was by himself, several hours after her first agonizing audience with King Galbatorix, when she had at long last fallen into a shallow, troubled sleep, Murtagh had come alone to the hall of the soothsayer, bleary-eyed and smelling of drink. He had stood by the monolith upon which she lay, and he had stared at her with such a strange, tormented expression, she had not been sure what he was going to do. At last he had turned away, walked to the nearest wall, and slid down it to the floor. There he sat, with his knees pulled up against his chest, his long shaggy hair obscuring most of his face, and blood oozing from the torn skin on the knuckles of his right hand. After what felt like minutes, he had reached into his maroon jerkin, for he was wearing the same clothes as earlier, although without the mask, and drawn forth a small stone bottle. He drank several times, and then began to talk. He talked, and she listened. She had no choice, but she did not allow herself to believe what he said, not at first. For all she knew, everything he said or did was a sham, designed to win her confidence. Murtagh had started by telling her a rather garbled story about a man named Tornak, which involved a riding mishap and some sort of advice Tornak had given him regarding how an honourable man ought to live. She had been unable to make out whether Tornak was a friend, a servant, a distant relative, or some combination thereof. But whatever he was, it was obvious that he had meant a great deal to Murtagh. When he concluded his story, Murtagh had said, "Galbatorix was going to have you killed. He knew Elva wasn't guarding you as she used to, so he decided it was the perfect time to have you assassinated. I only found out about his plan by chance. I happened to be with him when he gave the orders to the Black Hand." Murtagh shook his head. "It's my fault. I convinced him to have you brought here instead. He liked that. He knew you would lure Aragorn here that much faster. It was the only way I could keep him from killing you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." And he buried his head in his arms. "I would rather have died." "I know," he said in a hoarse voice. "Will you forgive me?" That she had not answered. His revelation only made her more uneasy. Why should he care to save her life? And what did he expect in return? Murtagh had said nothing more for a while. Then, sometimes weeping and sometimes raging, he told her of his upbringing in Galbatorix's court, of the distrust and jealousy he had faced as the son of Morzan, of the nobles who had sought to use him to win favour with the king, and of his longing for the mother he barely remembered. Twice he mentioned Aragorn, and cursed him for a fool favoured by fortune. He would not have done so well if our places had been reversed, but our mother chose to take him to Carvajal, not me. He spat on the floor. She found the whole episode maudlin and self-pitying, and his weakness did nothing but inspire contempt in her, until he recounted how the twins had abducted him from Farthendur, how they had mistreated him on the way to Urbane, and how Galbatorix had broken him once they arrived. Some of the tortures he described were worse than her own, and if true, gave her a slight measure of sympathy for his own plight. "Thorn was my undoing," Murtagh finally confessed, "when he hatched for me and we bonded." He shook his head. "I love him. How could I not? I love him even as Aragorn loves Saphira. The moment I touched him, I was lost. Galbatorix used him against me. Thorn was stronger than me. He never gave up. But I could not bear to see him suffer. So I swore my loyalty to the king. And after that..." Murtagh's lips curled with revulsion. "After that, Galbatorix went into my mind. He learned everything about me. And then he taught me my true name, and now I am his. His forever." Then he leaned his head against the wall and closed his eyes, and she watched the tears roll down his cheeks. Eventually he stood, and as he walked toward the door, he paused next to her and touched her on the shoulder. His nails, she noted, were clean and trimmed, but nowhere near as well cared for as her jailer's. He murmured a few words in the ancient language, and a moment later her pain melted away, although her wounds looked the same as ever. As he took his hand away, she said, "I cannot forgive, but I understand." Whereupon he nodded and stumbled away, leaving her to wonder if she had found a new ally.